Hello, and welcome to another episode of Django Chat. This week, we're joined by Nicholas Tollervey to talk about teaching Django and all the many hats he wears in the community. How are you, Nicholas?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. And also, Carlton is here as always. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hi, Carlton.
So we met, well, if you call it meeting, at PyCon, though. I've been a fan of your work for a long time from afar, and you have such a broad background. I wonder, what's the quick version of, you know, why are you at PyCon? How do you do all these hats? And then we'll get into teaching Django and all the rest of it.
Okay, so...
So who are you?
So who am I? I often ask myself that question. Okay, so the thumbnail sketch is, as a kid growing up in the UK in the 80s, we had 8-bit micros, and I was the recipient of all the work that went on in schools. Then my mum and dad were both teachers, and they used to bring home the school's BBC micro, and my brother and I learnt BBC Basic when, I don't know, I'd be about 8 or 9, and it was a case of, you know, 10 CLS, 20, print, you're an idiot, 30, go to line 20, that sort of stuff.
And then Carlton, was this for you too, Carlton?
Just yeah, no, exactly. I'm smiling because that is exactly my experience.
But were you a Spectrum guy, a Commodore guy, or a BBC guy?
I was a BBC guy, and later fantastic. On I was an Acorn Archimedes guy.
Okay, so our stories are exactly the same. I graduated
to an cool.
Archimedes.
Nice to meet you.
Fantastic. It has a lot to answer for, the BBC micro.
So that's not the case in the US, so that's why the...
hence BBC.
Well, the thing is that there was a report published a few years ago, the sort of 20th anniversary of this thing, and they think that the reason that there's so many video games in the UK, video games companies in the UK, that a lot of it is down to the fact that, you know, the people who are working in them and designing these games all started on the BBCs and the Spectrums and the Commodores and things in the 80s. So it has a lot to answer for.
The stuff you've done with the Microbit project, you sort of brought that to the new generation, right? I mean, that's, you put a physical device in the hands of secondary?
Yeah.
11-year-olds, okay.
Yeah.
So we should quickly say what the Microbit project is here to introduce.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. The BBC, again, wanted to do some intervention in the spirit of the BBC Micro from the 80s. So they asked themselves, well, what would it look like for today? You know, it would need to be small, handheld, mobile, communicate, that sort of stuff. Maybe an Internet of Things sort of thing. And so they came up with the concept of a Microbit. And they invited, at the end of 2015, partners to become a part of the Microbit project. Now, the BBC, because it's funded from the license fee, have to be very careful about interventions that they make, because, of course, if the BBC say, we're going to go into the computing education world, then those companies in the UK who are in the computing education world are going to be rather frightened, because there's rather a large organisation with huge amounts of resources. So the way they got around that was by having a partnership, which was under the umbrella of the BBC, and it was individual companies and organizations such as the Python Software Foundation who contributed to the partnership to deliver the project. And so in the spring of 2017, 1 million of these devices were given out to kids in the UK. So every 11-year-old in the UK got one. The Python Software Foundation was a partner in this project. And Damien George, who's the creator of MicroPython, volunteered a huge amount of time and effort in making MicroPython run on the device. And I built a whole bunch of tools that went around it. And there were, I guess, about 80 volunteers in the wider, mostly UK Python community, but we had some international contributions as well. So about 80 volunteers to a greater or lesser extent, submitting resources, code, time, that sort of stuff. And the device itself is about the size of a playing card. It has a 5x5 LED screen, a couple of buttons, an accelerometer, GPIO pins, a compass,
wow, yeah.
And very simple networking as well, that could be Bluetooth capable, except they forgot to put enough memory in the device. So
genius.
Nobody can make the damn thing work with Bluetooth properly.
Fine. And are these available to buy still?
Yes.
Like if you wanted one, because lots of people are into that kind of thing.
Yeah, go grab it from Adafruit, for example, or some other online shop like that. But, you know, perhaps one of the things that makes me most happy about the legacy of Microbit is that you now have a whole bunch of other folks doing something very, very similar. So you have in China, there's the Sinobit, which is based on the Microbit, but has rather a larger LED screen because, of course, the characters in Chinese are a lot more complicated than the Western alphabet. There's the Calliope in Germany. And, of course, as we've been at PyCon, we all got an Adafruit Circuit Playground Express. And Adafruit have been... That's just amazing, that board. And this sort of Python for embedded... It is gaining momentum, and it's a wonderful thing to see.
Yeah, and can you explain about MicroPython? Because that's a really interesting project, and you mentioned it, but...
Yeah, so MicroPython is the creation of Damien George. Damien is a physicist by training. He was based in Cambridge in the UK, and he worked on stuff to do with the Large Hadron Collider, and that's about as much as I'm prepared to say, because it gets a lot more technical after that, and I don't know. But it sounds very impressive if you go look him up on his Cambridge University website. So he's obviously an academic, but whilst an undergraduate, he had an interest in robotics, and he wrote a very simple scripting language for the Robo World Cup entry from his university in Australia when he was an undergraduate. And this involved him writing a compiler for embedded systems and things like that. And that experience and his interest in robotics and the fact that he was looking at the computing ecosystem wondering, well, what scripting language is popular and well known that might attract people to this sort of project led him to decide to create MicroPython. And so he had a proof of concept working, and then he did the famous Kickstarter where he said you'll get a Pi board if you support more than $50 or whatever it was. And then he was expecting to maybe raise $10,000 at the most, and $100,000 later, the world obviously wanted MicroPython. And he's done other stuff, other Kickstarters since. But MicroPython is Python, a full re-implementation of Python 3 for embedded and microcontroller-based devices. It can run in as little as 8K of RAM. And the way Damien has written it is a feat of software engineering. Really, it is. You've got pretty much the whole language there. And if you're used to working in embedded systems and you're working in C, and every time you do a new project, you have to reinvent the wheel, and then you get Python and you have the data structures, exception handling,
the strings,
or memory management, all this sort of stuff already there, then it's a revelation. When I was working with Damien, he was telling me that he had sort of C programmers saying, you know, this thing, it's taken me like a couple of hours this afternoon. It would normally take a week in C. And this speaks to MicroPython's power, because people will often criticize it and say, well, you know, MicroPython, it's interpreted, it's going to be slow and what have you. But actually, it's often fast enough, and it's possible to write the bits that you need to be fast in C and import them as modules into MicroPython. But most importantly, it's software developers who are the most expensive part of this equation. And MicroPython makes this so easy, so quick, so fast, and such a joy to write in this. We know, Python's a beautiful language.
What you just said is the story of Python at every level, not just MicroPython, regular. You know, you can write it faster in Go or Rust or C or whatever, but Python will be fast enough. And your software developer time is much more expensive by an order of magnitude. And, you know, it's a joy to write, and you're more productive. And that, you know, it's brilliant that at every level that applies exactly the same.
Yeah, it's Python's... It's one of Python's secret weapons, really. It'll come into I don't know, if I was a business type, it comes into a particular market, and and what's been there before is often difficult or fiddly or time consuming, and Python, because, you know, Guido's great insight, readability counts, and the other sort of set of Python tropes that we have, they really are important. And the community's awesome as well. It's a fantastic community. Who wouldn't want to be a part of it?
Right. Well, let's see. I took us a field from your background, but
yeah.
Let me, if I could. I mean, my 10-second take, and you've given many, many talks, so partly I didn't want you to have to say the same things, yeah. As, you know, classically trained in tuba, musician, then you taught and were, what, head of music at numerous schools throughout your 20s.
Yeah.
And then you got into C# ASP.NET, right, before Python?
Yeah. So whilst I was a teacher, I was using Linux because the Windows 3.1 machine that I'd inherited from my father-in-law kept crashing, and I'd installed naively this Linux thing, and I was using it to plan my work and do my kind of paperwork and things. I was having a lot of time, so I was aware of open source free software. When my children arrived, I did an MSc in computing as a conversion to allow me to sort of step out of teaching and into computing, because it was something that I was interested in. And my first job was using C#. And because I only had commercial experience in C#, the only jobs I really went for were C# jobs. My last job as a C# developer was at an investment bank in London. I was working with a bunch of quants. They wanted to script the tool that I had written for them. And Iron Python, this is, I don't know, 2007, 2008, Iron Python was becoming a blip on people's radar, and Microsoft had been investing time in what they call the DLR, the dynamic language runtime. I have no idea what's become of that. But I encountered Iron Python. I went to PyCon, the very first PyCon UK, met John Pinner, who gave a free course in Python. It was an incredibly welcoming community. And John was, who's since passed away, sadly. Without John, the UK Python community would be nothing, really. But that autumn had a big effect on me, and I thought, well, okay, I've got enough money to spend maybe 3 months of my time retraining in Python, doing something, and getting a new job in Python. Interestingly, for this podcast, the mechanism, the vehicle for that was via a Django website.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. And what was that like back in the day? Because obviously I'm aware of sort of current,
yeah,
you know, it feels like there's not a lot of ways to learn Django currently. I mean, it's growing, but I mean, 10 years ago, right? What was the landscape like? Why Django, right? Because it wasn't necessarily, you know, there were still, but there are a number of other options that Django hadn't had the sort of supremacy that Django and Flask have today.
Yeah, that's right. So I knew Python was the language. I'd used Ruby on Rails, and Django felt close-ish because other options were things like Plone and Zope and things like that. I wanted to use the web because I'd been an ASP.NET developer. I'd done an awful lot of work in addition to the Windows Forms work I've been doing at the bank. So I knew HTML and how to write a website in broad terms. And what I found was that the documentation for Django has always been extraordinarily good. A touchstone, I'd say, for other projects to copy. So I just followed the tutorial. Wrote what I can't even remember. It might even have been a blog.
I think was it polls back then, or it probably hasn't. Do you know, Carlton? I assume it hasn't changed.
It's been the same as long as I can remember. But
yeah. It was some, you know, some ABC,
some crud thing.
Yeah. ABC crud thing. So that took about a week. So I was, whilst I was doing the tutorial, I was also reading around the technology that I was using as well. And so what I decided to do was create a job website where people could post jobs and people could apply for them. Again, a simple CRUD thing as a kind of an academic exercise. And I found that within about 3 weeks, I was more productive using Django and Python as a beginner Python developer than I was as an ASP.NET C# developer with, you know, 6 or 7 years experience of doing that. And this was a real revelation to me.
And that's even with the tooling.
Yeah.
Because Microsoft traditionally provide good tooling and...
do they? the number of times Visual Studio managed to rewrite my code to neaten it up. Readability counts. We know this with Pythonistas. And then seeing sort of code spaghetti as Visual Studio has munched your HTML. Yes, it's a double-edged sword. If I'm honest with you, I'm quite old school and just use Vim.
Yeah, right.
And the tooling, I'm healthily cynical about it, but we use it when needed.
I saw that one of the projects you mentioned, the job board, one of the projects you worked on was at the Guardian on their dating site, right? So that's, yeah. I mean, the logistics of that are, was that because you knew you were going to be working on that you did the job board? Because that's sort of pretty similar. Dating site, or
no?
That's the best segue ever. Jobs to dating. It's
remarkably
same
similar, actually.
Makes sense to me, Carlton.
Think about it. You've got a person and you need a funnel of people who are approaching you for whatever reason, to get a job or to go on a date. And you sift through them and you either give them a job or you go on a date. And then so on and so forth. Yeah. But rinse and repeat. The Guardian stuff came after I'd done quite a bit of Python program. I'd been a Python programmer 4 or 5 years maybe when I did The Guardian. It was an interesting place to work, I can tell you, because I was there when the Snowden revelations were happening. And every morning they have a morning conference, and I got our morning stand-up moved so that we could all go. And there you'd see sort of Russ Bridger, the editor, and all the other folks in the room discussing what the day's news was. Anybody could attend, and it was just fascinating watching a newsroom. And thinking about it, it was their morning stand-up, except that they were talking about Snowden and what was happening in US elections, or, you know, the way Downing Street was dealing with such and such a thing. So it was a fascinating place to work.
And are they still Django Stack or something like that?
When I was there, the dating website was Django, and it was backed by MongoDB. The main website is a Java app, though. Which is built in house. I think, no, not Java, it's JVM, so it's Scala, is what they used. But it could have all changed by now. I was there 2013, 2014, something like that.
Okay. Well, and I know you're incredibly involved in Python and teaching realm, and I want to talk about that, but I'm also, you have this perspective of, you know, where do you see Django fitting into all that? Because my sense was, this is my first PyCon. I know you've been to many, that maybe 4 or 5 years ago, Django and the web was a bigger presence, whereas now, you know, I went to a talk that Jacob Kaplan-Moss gave, and not that many people there. Fantastic talk. I mean, it was very much a secondary citizen, which, you know, I'm in the Django world, so it was eye-opening to me. I'm curious how you've, you know, seen that evolution of the web and, you know, just Python, and there's hardware, and what you make of all all that with your experience. Because it's, you know, it's all new to me. I was like, wow, maybe... Like, where do they get their data for the web, you know, for all this stuff? I was like, well, I don't know, somehow. So I guess that's more of a thought rather than a question. I guess a question would be, when were your first PyCons and how have you seen those develop over time? Because it was a fantastic experience and it's a little bit different than a DjangoCon.
Yeah, so my first PyCons were 2007. I think I went to my first DjangoCon. It was a Euro DjangoCon. That had been 2010-ish, 29.
That's before Carlton, right?
Yeah. No, but I was in the closet for years. I've been using Django forever, but I'd never went to a Django event until like 2017. And then I was like, wow, why have I not been before? This is...
Yeah. I think I was lucky because I experienced the community very early in my sort of Python story. When I remember EuroPython in 2010, which was held in the UK, Django was everywhere because I think 1.0 had just been released. Django this, Django that, Django the other. It was all over the place. And this made me very happy because I was earning a living making Django stuff. In terms of the evolution, and you mentioned, you know, Django seems to sort of be a second class citizen. I and also its relation to education. I don't see that. I think this is just a natural sort of life story, the journey of a piece of software, in that it starts, you know, as being kind of under the radar, and then all of a sudden it becomes the next shiny new thing, like MicroPython. Perhaps is, or CircuitPython currently is, and then things mature. It's like the Gartner hype cycle, really. And I think Django as a project has been extraordinarily, well, at least from the outside, from my perspective, well run and steered, so that you have this solid stack that that folks you know, have no problem using. It's so good at its job, it's almost sort of boring.
Plumbing. It's kind of like the plumbing now.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't mean it's boring, you know, yawn boring. I mean it's business as usual sort of stuff. You know, I want to write a Python website. Well, my first thought is, okay, I'll use Django for that. Because I understand what the steps are likely to be, or what the stack might look like. So it's not an unexpected proposition, and this is, in a sense, a good thing, because there are no surprises. But to speak of Django and education, the sort of elephant in the room with that is Django Girls and the work that Ola and Ola have been doing with that, which is phenomenal. It always gives me a huge Cheshire Cat like grin to think of the stuff that they've done, I think the genius that they have is they realize that people want to be able to write their own website, because it's a kind of a, hey, mum, do you see what I've built? And you can point your granny, yep, or your mum or your dad or your uncle or your son or your daughter to this thing. And it's this very simple blog, so people get it. And in a day, you've created something that you can feel proud of. It feels like, I don't know, and I've been a mentor on several Django Girls, but looking at the end result at the end of the day, people feel proud of their work. And what's more important is that people can see how they might change their blog and customize it. And that's what you want, is that they've been given the foundation, they've got the skills now to start experimenting, and they feel ownership over this code. So Django Girls forever, that's what I say.
No, entirely. There's two, I did mentoring at Django Girls Barcelona, and kind of two moments that really stuck out for me. One was when they cracked open the shell, and you know, we've created these models, and all of a sudden they're in the shell and they're querying the ORM, and then all of a sudden they're flying the ORM, and you see the spark, and they're like, ah, and it's like, yeah, you're driving it. And that was magic. And then the second for my group was towards the end of the day, when they started to push beyond and they said, oh, I could put a map in here. And you know, they've just gone on to Google and, you know, got the snippet from Google and embed it in the HTML, and it's like, look, I put a map on my blog.
So that what I really like, I'm going to step back and do a kind of a meta thing here, is it's not only that mentors like the at Django Girls see the sort of the joy of coding in the Django Girls who turn up to learn, but what I like to see is what you've just done, which is seeing people who are usually professional coders who have been asked to mentor at Django Girls. Everybody has their like favorite story about that time when, well, you just said, I could put a map in here, I could do this thing. So it speaks to me, because having been a teacher, I know what a rewarding experience that can be. And I think that as software developers, as part of our career development, perhaps at some point, we're always going to have to mentor somebody else, a junior programmer or a new hire that needs to understand how the system works and get up to speed, or repair programming. And you need to develop the skills of being able to explain and listen, importantly, listen. And listening to you just now was, you know, another one of those moments. So it's good. Good that this happens. Django Girls facilitates so much good stuff in lots of subtle ways.
More power to it.
So let's maybe, how's this for a segue? So Mew, I want to ask about that because...
Seamless.
So see, Carlton, we're learning something over time. So this is awesome because one of the takeaways from anyone who's tried to use Python is it can be challenging to install and everyone's on different computers. And so this is not just web-based, but deliberately simplified, right? So we'll link to the website. And you want to...
Yeah, so it's not web-based. It's a native code editor.
Oh, sorry.
Don't worry. Although I have...
I'm not afraid to be ignorant on the podcast.
No, don't worry. So it was written as part of the PSS contribution to Microbit. I wrote a browser-based Python editor for Microbit. And being a good engineer, I hope, I took it out and tried it out on teachers and students and developers and things. And the feedback I got was, whilst it's convenient to have a Python editor in a browser, actually, because of the limitations of a browser being a sandbox and things, we can't connect to the REPL through USB serial, or you couldn't back then. And you couldn't do this, that, and the other. And so I sat down one Sunday afternoon thinking, you know, how hard can it be to write a simple yeah. code editor for users? You know, I've got PyQt, that's a mature platform. There's Qcintilla, so I could use that as a widget. We just need some, you know, new load, save, run type buttons. That's all you need. And Mew was born, and people started using it, much to my surprise. And after a while, people started asking, well, could rather than just being a Microbit editor, native editor, could you make it a generic Python editor? And so the Raspberry Pi Foundation were very gracious and supported me in a block of time where I was able to do the refactoring and turn it into a generic beginner's Python editor. So it also has a debugger and... The REPL is an IPython REPL and so on and so forth. And so it's sort of grown from there. But what we did, or what I did at that time, is went around lots of schools to observe how teachers were using the Python stack. And they were using IDLE. And IDLE's great because it's always going to be there. But it's based on tkinter, so it really looks like it's from 1997. this is off-putting to, you know, teenagers who might not be used to that sort of GUI widget set. And there are other sorts of, how can I put it, pedagogical problems with IDLE. Kids are forever losing the two windows behind each other. And so, you know, IDLE is an amazing tool, but, you know, there are certain ways in which it could be improved, or it's not... It needs UX love and things like that. So I did all that stuff, and the next generation of Mew, the next version of Mew, sorry, was created. And the other interesting revelation was that I got to meet with school network admins who generally live in some dark room in the basement of a school, and even the teachers only hear of them via rumor. But I managed to find several of them and entice them with a cup of tea to just have a chat with me about what their work entailed. And essentially, and unsurprisingly, it was just make it as easy as you can for us to be able to install this thing in such a way that the students won't be able to take down my network. So Mew, actually, if you use the package version of Mew, the installer for Windows and OS X, comes with Python bundled in it. So it doesn't use system Python if you have Python already. Because a lot of schools, the attitude of the network admins was, you know, I'm not letting children anywhere near Python on my shiny school network. It's taking me years to make it like that. And kind of a classic aside here is I was at a school in Northampton recently where the network admins, you know, Python was a was like a swear word for them, because a student had worked out that in the sys module you could automate the shutting down of the operating system. And so they'd written a little script that did the equivalent on Windows of shutdown minus H now, you know, hard shutdown.
Yeah.
So just close everything, switch it off. He emailed it to a friend. He double-clicked right. it, and his machine switched off. And if you're 14 years old, this is hilarious. So he switched his machine back on and then emailed it to everybody else in the year. This is the second kid, not the kid who originated the script. And of course, what happens is that everybody in his year clicks this thing, and people were losing their work because they had Word open or they were on a website filling in a form or something like that. And so I pointed out to the network admins that actually this kid should be congratulated because he's only automating something that, you know, you're allowed to do anyway. You can click start and then shut down to close the machine down. It's just he'd done what any programmer does, which is feel a bit lazy and automate something. So it was a good life lesson. But what I'm getting to is that network admins, they are small c conservative and very, very risk averse because their job depends on it, really. And so putting a programming language that makes it easy for children to do interesting things with computers, it's like their worst nightmare. So what we do with Mew is Python's bundled with it. And so the kids can't actually, they can only use Python via Mew. Really. So, and it also means that the network admins, if they want to install Mew on a computing suite or several classrooms, they only have one thing to install. They don't have to first install Python and then install the dependencies and then install Mew. It's just a single package. So I might be laboring a point here, but this is so incredibly important for the folks who actually administer things in schools.
I think this is something that Python more generally could learn from as well.
You know,
people come to it and it's like, install Python. Ah, okay. That's still non-trivial. Yeah. And then, you know.
Yeah, packaging is hard, and especially if you want to create a standalone Python app on the desktop. Now, I realize that that's not a typical Python app. You know, I'd say maybe a typical Python app is, say, for example, a Django website or something like that, in which case you're accessing the Python assets through a web browser, interacting with the website. But if you want to have a desktop app, you know, Russell Keith McGee's Beware is an astounding project, and I recommend everybody go listen to his keynote from PyCon 2019 this year.
But you just mentioned it. His keynote here, exactly about this, is like what happens when, you know, everybody hasn't got a laptop where, you know, we've got a tablet and, well, you know, is Python going to be available on that tablet? Can I code in Python on that tablet? And if I can't, am I going to choose Python?
Yeah. Yes. Well, I was talking yesterday, somebody wanted to cross platform, mobile-friendly app, and essentially the simplest way to do it is to shim a website within an app. You know, you get various frameworks where they use the browser as a way of delivering a mobile app. And so you write JavaScript and HTML, and then it's packaged up for iOS and iPads and Android and things. And, well, where's the Python story in that? We're in danger of missing the whole mobile thing. And packaging and embedding Python within your application assets so that it runs properly, that's a non-trivial problem. And I have spent an inordinate amount of time feeling the pain of packaging Mew so that teachers and network admins don't have to, that they get an easy story at the end of it. And it would be so good if we could do the same sort of thing for, if there was as they say in the end of Python, there should be one and one obvious way of doing it.
There needs to be a standard story that, you know, I want to bundle Python. Here's how you do it.
Yes, exactly. A tool or a way of doing it that's a no-brainer that covers most things apart from the difficult edge cases. So you've got sort of the 80-20 rule going on there as well. So for most people, it will work. And Russell is making significant inroads into that. His briefcase project, which is part of Beware, is something that Mew uses. It was just beautifully simple to package things for OS X using Russell Keith McGee's work. And he's put a huge amount of effort into it. So kudos to him. He deserves all the respect and celebration that he's getting at the moment. And he needs help as well, financial support and ways of folks paying for the work that needs to be done to make this fundamental sort of infrastructure work. But now I'm just echoing his keynote, and he does it so much better. So go and watch his keynote.
He does. He sets a high bar. Yeah, we'll link to that.
Yeah.
That talk. I was able to be in the room for it. Well, so one of the takeaways I had from Well, actually, I wanted to say, so the teaching tracks at these Python events, because I know you were involved with setting up the first one at PyCon UK, right?
That's right, yeah.
So one of the things I heard teachers say, again, this won't be new to you, is that they keep repeating the same content over and over again.
Yeah.
And I know you have, what are your thoughts on that? I don't want to...
So we're going into code grades territory here, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm staring at the code grade site, so I was sort of... So I wanted to get at that too.
I'm going to use a friend of mine as a typical example. And she's called Dawn Hewitson, and she is the lead tutor, the person who runs the course at Edgehill University in the UK that trains computing teachers. And Ofsted, we have this thing called Ofsted in the UK. It's the Office for Standards in Education, and they are basically the school inspectors. And Dawn's course is rated the highest in the whole of the UK for computing teacher education. And Dawn made a fantastic point a few months ago when we were chatting, which was that we have so many beginner Python things. Make an LED blink, say hello world, make a simple blog, that sort of stuff. And yet, as professional software developers, the sorts of learning that we do are perhaps based on an in-depth technical discussion on Stack Overflow, or reading something on Read the Docs, or auditing the source code and what have you. And so in this continuum of educational resources, everything's on either side. There's nothing kind of in the middle. How do you get from one end to the other? And this reminded me of the problem of how you train musicians. How do you get the 5-year-old little girl scratching away on the violin and entertaining the local cats become Nicola Benedetti, a sort of a concert violinist, virtuoso violinist. At some point she got a little bit better and then a little bit better, and then she was kind of average and then she was good and so on and so forth. People have to go through this process. You're not just born a violin virtuoso. You have to figure out where to put your fingers and how to hold the bow and things like that. And so the way we do this in the UK, and it's a very successful system, it's been around for about 150 years. And this also speaks to the fact that music education, I have 500 years of music education I can draw upon, whereas in programming education, I don't know, 20 years, we've only been programming.
And the violin hasn't changed. Yeah, doesn't change every 9 months.
Yeah, and there's been enough time in the world of music to have revolutions, counter-revolutions, and consolidations, and different schools of thought, and so on and so forth. And that's not so much the case in programming. And so, having been a music teacher, I thought, well, what could I borrow from the world of music and transpose? no pun intended. Transpose into the world of technical education. And so this notion of music grades is the first thing that happened, although that it's a rich vein, and I have lots of ideas about how we could use techniques using music pedagogy to help in technical education, computing education. But music grades work like this. Grade one is easy enough that most people who practice semi-regularly will be able to take a grade one after only a few months. Okay. And what happens in a grade? Well, what you're doing is you're practicing what a musician actually does. You go in and you give a performance, and you have to give a performance that has three pieces in it. And then you're also asked to sight read music, which is something else that musicians have to learn to do. And then you get some oral tests. So we sort of check out your listening ability, and you might have to sing back as well, because musicians are always doing that sort of thing. And finally, you might be asked to play some scales and arpeggios, or an orchestral exort or something, because scales and arpeggios are like the Lego bricks building blocks of how you play and perform your instrument. And so for grade one, you have three buckets containing, about 10 pieces each, and you choose one piece from each bucket so that you'll get a nice little recital out of it. And those pieces are appropriate for grade one. So grade one is very, very easy. Okay. And then by the time you've taken grade one, you've got a feather in your cap. You've had some feedback from the examiner who listened to you. This examiner is a professional musician. They're probably an expert in your instrument as well. And you get a mark so you can see which aspects of your performances were good and which need work on and that sort of stuff. And you get written feedback as well that tells you in an encouraging and a supportive way the sorts of things that you should perhaps think about or well done in that first piece. You really set the tempo and the mood really well. I really enjoyed what you did at letter J, but think about the tuning at letter Z or something like that. It's that sort of feedback.
Letter J, I like that, yeah.
Well, these are rehearsal marks in music, so we know where we are, so we can talk about a specific bar in a piece of music. And so you take your grade one, and then grade two comes into view. It doesn't seem so impossible because you've acquired the skills for grade one. You've, as it were, you've passed. No one can take away from you the fact that you are now a grade one pianist or trombonist or, you know, flute player or something. So you take your grade two and so on and so forth, rinse and repeat until you get to grade eight. And grade eight is kind of, I don't know, like black belt at karate in music. And
one of my lasting memories of sixth form is all my musical friends stressing to death about their grade eight, you know, whatever. And
yeah, well, if you get to grade eight, so to audition for music conservatoire, you need to be grade eight. The important thing is that in music education and in the wider musical world, folks will say, oh, I'm grade six at such and such a thing. And people kind of know what that level is. And so if you're joining a youth orchestra, they might say you need to be grade five or above. And so it's also a signal to those people who might not be confident, but they are grade six. So they're one grade better than the minimum requirements that perhaps maybe I will audition for it. So it's also important because it's a trajectory as well. You can see where you're going to. You can see when you go to music school on a Saturday morning and you're only grade three and you see the grade eight sixth formers, your buddies from school, doing amazing things. You can see what you're aiming for, and what sort of skills and what sort of music you're playing and how cool they sound when they do that electric guitar riff or they're playing in their jazz combo or the string quartet plays this beautiful piece of music. And so I thought, well, if we were to do that with programming, what would that look like? And this is where Code Grades comes in. And like music, it's eight grades. What I wanted to do so far, in its early days, I wanted to test whether the idea would work. So before Christmas, I helped a cohort, a handful of folks, learn grade one Python, which is very basic Python. What they were asked to do was prepare a project of their own devising. So they had ownership of this code. It was something that they were passionate about, or it was a problem that they wanted to solve, or in one case, it was a game that they wanted to play. And they needed to show some core concepts that matched to the level of attainment for grade one. Okay, so we need to see that you understand what loops are, or that you can call functions, or you understand how assignment works. These are very basic things, but with that sort of stuff, you can make very simple projects. And then I asked a friend of mine, Tim Golden, who's a core developer, Python core developer, to play the part of an examiner. And these rather nervous beginner programmers came along and they did two things. They presented their project to Tim one-to-one, and it was like a code review where you stand up and you say, this is my piece, this is my project, this is why I wrote it, this is how it works, let me show you the code. And Tim would ask them questions and make sure that they were sort of ticking all the boxes for the requirements. And then the second thing that they did is they did a paired programming task where they were given a short fragment of code and it had two errors in it for grade one, a syntax error and a runtime error. And they had to just sit there and debug it together so they could ask questions of each other, but it allowed Tim to get a feel of how this person approached code, watch them make mistakes, see what sort of questions they asked, see how they were actually getting into the code and interpreting and reasoning about it. And then at the end, he filled in a Google form and they were given marks, and that was an entirely positive experience for them. They would arrive very nervous. They would go in and do their stuff. They would come out and sort of wipe their forehead and go, phew, I'm pleased that's over. And I say, well, how did it go? And they said, oh, I forgot about this, or I didn't do that. You know, you go through all the things that you wish you'd said. And then they'd go, but actually the demo went really well. And he laughed when my game started. And he really liked the way that I used the loop within the loops to do the thing. So actually it wasn't that bad. And when we put together the feedback for the people who took the grades so that they could see how their project had gone and how their pair programming task had gone, the feedback we got from that was universally good, because they really liked the fact that somebody was telling them where they were making mistakes, giving them ideas about what they should improve. It allowed them to see where their weaknesses were and things like that. And so all of them said, well, when can I do my next code grade? And so since the new year, you know, grade one Python before Christmas was me making it up as I went along. Now I've been working on 8 grades for Python. And
you've got 8?
Go on, sorry.
There are 8.
There are 8.
There are 8.
I would say I'm about 60% through this process of making the syllabus for it.
Wowza.
So there are 8 grades. When you write a syllabus or educational resources, you don't just make it up as you go along. You have to make sure that things line up in the right way. And you also need to make sure that you revisit things as well. So I've been sort of going back to my geeking out as a teacher, putting on my teacher hat and thinking about when I was writing a school curriculum for a music department and thinking about and going through that sort of a process, analyzing what sort of knowledge, what sort of skills, what sorts of social interactions, because this is important to software developers, should the people taking grades encounter, and when should that happen on the story, and what needs to be in place before they can get to that place. So the way I did it was I started with grade one. What would the first step look like so that it was appealing to people? And then I did grade eight. You know, what's the end point? And grade eight, if you're grade eight, you are a competent junior developer. You understand GitHub. You understand how to merge code. You understand object orientation. You could write unit tests. You can write a test suite. You know what continuous integration is. You can take part in a code review. You have written a website. You have done, you know, all this sort of stuff. So somebody who's turning up to an open source project or their first job in code, and they have the skills necessary to build on those. So that's
what I love about this idea is the point you made earlier about having the confidence, because they're only asking for grade 5 and I'm grade 6. And so many people I see are unwilling to bet on their own ability. And, you know, and that's natural. And it's, you know, the imposter syndrome is a real thing. But, you know, to find to be given an objective measure that helps you overcome that is just phenomenal. Fantastic.
Yeah. It's thank you. It's imposter syndrome, as you say. I mean, I have that. You know, I'll be honest, I'm a classically trained musician. and whenever I'm stood up, I'm forever thinking, just when are they going to find out? You know, I might be really good at playing the tuba, but, you know, this programming stuff is stuff I've picked up as I've gone along, really, to be honest with you.
I think musicians make the best coders, though. I mean, here in Boston, there's any number of, you know, there's a Berklee College of Music, you know, folks who've, you know, who self-taught, and just they have, as you said, they have that structure, they have the idea of dedicated practice. And just that progression, right? Because when I'm, no one can even say what level you're at. I mean, at PyCon, I met a number of people who'd read my book or were learning Django, and they just have this sense of, they just don't know where to put themselves. And so, that leads imposter syndrome when it looks like an ocean of knowledge and there's no... it's such a brilliant idea.
Yeah, well, I had a conversation yesterday where I was talking to a friend who is an exceptionally talented software developer. She's a very talented software developer. And she said to me, she confided in me, she said, you know what, I'm not sure I understand this or that about Python, but people think I do. And it's like, oh, imposter syndrome, it's terrible, terrible, terrible. We were sprinting on something, and at this point, she's involved in this particular project. Some random person came up, as they do in sprints, and said, hey, you know, I've got this problem. There's a thing that does a thing, but it doesn't do the thing which I was expecting to. And my friend said, oh, yeah, that's easy. What you want to do is blah, 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 blah. And beautifully and succinctly gave the technical support required for this person to be able to sprint. And I said to my friend, you know what? How can you possibly say, you know, you're worried about, you know, your technical competence when not 10 seconds later, you beautifully answer this email in this person's query in the sprint in a supportive and technical way. And so the code grades are, it's like an initiation. You've got your grade 5. No one can take that away from you. And by taking grade 5, you've shown you've done A, B, C, and D. Hopefully, it will be a confidence-building thing. Because like music, you need to have a lot of confidence in coding as well. It can be quite a frightening proposition.
Yeah, it can. I have to ask one question about it. In the music grades, there's this great barrier, this great milestone, which is the grade 5 theory test. So is there an equivalent of the grade 5 theory test where you have to learn about binary trees or something silly like that?
No.
Reverse a linked list.
Yeah, exactly.
On a whiteboard. Only on a whiteboard, not in a computer.
No. So the other important aspect of this is that the syllabus curriculum, whatever you want to call it, is written by, it's not just me who's writing, although I'm doing most of the legwork, I'm getting help. But it is professional, working, jobbing Python programmers who are contributing to what they believe should be in code grades.
Right, good.
Rather than a professor of computer science doing, you know, binary tree search or, I can't think of something now.
Well, you just did.
So. Tell core recursion or something like that. You know, you've got to learn about this stuff, and you do have to learn about this stuff. But this is more practical focused. It's about giving people the nuts and bolts and skills and the social mores and conventions so that they can engage initially with the Python community and become part of it and feel that they have the technical chops to be able to do the things that they want to do that they're interested in doing themselves. It's a kind of an emancipation exercise.
Super.
Yeah, I love that roadmap. I mean, I often think of that when I'm teaching of, you know, for web, right? Because there's so much involved with web and, you know, I think you mentioned you'd already sort of learned some of the basics of web stuff, but you know, some people, as people do, come to me and say, I don't know anything. I want to build a website. You know, what is that progression? What is that hierarchy? You know, if I can point to things. And also, as a teacher, like, it's so much more helpful to agree upon the concepts that we're going to cover. I love that idea because when people come in and volunteer, it's like, yeah, they're going to, you know, hop into Vim or something. But if it's like, nope, we're talking about this discrete level of concepts.
Yeah.
That really helps. Yeah, helps volunteers.
That's a really great point because in the UK, and I'm imagining all over the world, computing teachers often don't have a computing background. They are business studies teachers who have been co-opted into teaching computing, and they don't know anything about perhaps some of the more technical aspects of that subject, because obviously computing isn't just programming. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that kids do. But in the UK, there's a large part of it, though, is learning to code. And you have a bunch of teachers who are like, well, they're not professional coders. They've not seen what it is to be a coder or experienced writing a piece of code and releasing it and all the life cycle of what code is. And so so being able to share in a helpful and constructive way what it is that software developers, what coders expect coders do, is useful for teachers because then they can start to write resources that speak to that meet these requirements. And it also shows teachers, well, what sort of skills do I need to become a computing teacher as well?
I found that, again, picking up coding, I think even later in life than you, I mean, the hardest thing was the lack of good educational resources and a sense of progress. It's all just who knows. And I think maybe combined with the fact that, I mean, I also play musical instruments. My daughter is 6, so I'm hearing her scratch out these scales.
Yeah.
You know, there's, in a way, as programmers, we sort of write the script and then we don't practice the scales.
Yeah.
Right? Like as a musician, you know, a professional musician spends hours every day and you kind of, you're like, oh, I do know how to play this. Like it makes it better. But in programming, at least I've completely forgot something I learned because I just wrote a script and now I move on. And so that sort of yields the imposter syndrome because I go, well, I haven't done that thing in a year.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's sort of, I think expert level is you have a concept and you've done it once, but you know, like, well, I got to go look it up. You know, I don't, I can't sort this all in my head. Whereas, you know, whereas a musician, yeah. you know, right? It's whatever, you know, it's half the day is the fundamentals. A violinist anyways, I know some of those professionals, you know, they're yeah. just doing, you know, so I sort of wonder what is that, you know, I know there's like code katas and yeah. stuff, but.
I think that's perhaps a difference between music and coding though, is that when I was playing the tuba professionally, I kind of knew what sort of things I would be doing and the scales and, you know, all that sort of stuff and the breathing and the posture and the getting yourself into the right mental state as well. Music is an incredibly intense experience when you do it properly at a high level. But for the nature of our job in programming is that we are going to be ignorant of most of our subject area. You know, I know Python relatively well, but not as well as many other people, but I don't know Go, I don't know you know, Rust, I don't know C++ or anything like that. I don't have, although I have an MSc in computing, that wasn't an amazingly technical degree, so I don't have like a computer science background, I don't know about the academic aspects of this. And like you say, there's kind of a half-life of knowledge. You know, I yeah. learn about this thing, and then I met somebody who is the chair of the XMPP Foundation, you know, Jabber, that sort of stuff, at PyCon a couple of days ago. And I said to him, we used XMPP as a protocol for some federated system that I built in 2012 or something, in the startup that I was working for. He went, oh, right, oh, excellent. So did you use this, or this? And I was like, well, I have no idea. I can't remember. But I remember XMP was really helpful in this particular problem. But being ignorant is part of our job. And knowing that you're ignorant is an important aspect of that. I mean, Socrates said, you know, wisest are they that know they know nothing. I think that holds very well for programmers.
And one good test of a program is how quick they can get the docs open.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. 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 And I think as programmers mature, I know, and I'm speaking for myself only here, is that I've done enough different things that I know you could potentially do a thing. And I once did a thing like that. And so I have in the back of my mind the right words or concepts to Google or where the documentation might be or the name of the person who was maintaining that library so that I might be able to drop them an email because we once had a beer at PyCon 3 years ago, that sort of thing. But it's certainly not, you know, I have now retained the specification for XMPP from 2012. That's certainly not the case. And
but it's kind of strategies that might work, you know, you sort yeah. of, as time goes by, you kind of learn to start in the right way. It's not that you've got a solution, but you kind of think, well, that kind of shape is going to be about right here, and this kind of shape will be about right there, and a little bit while later it fits together, and that happens, and that's nice.
Yeah, but there's also scar tissue. I mean, that's the...
Yeah.
I was talking to some educators, and they were telling me the things they wanted to build. You know, they didn't know web, but they knew Python, things they wanted to build, and I'm just sitting there thinking, oh my God, you know, they're like, well, I'm in a third-party API call, this enterprise system, and I'm going to have 12 of those, and you know, it was great for me. I was like, oh, I love your optimism and yeah. your ignorance, right? Because yeah. it may have gotten better, but I'm just seeing all the problems. And there is a little bit of a, you know, Eeyore aspect to programming where you're just thinking of problems.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, that scar tissue, I love having those conversations with people who don't know anything because they, you know, they open my mind and they're so excited. And, you know, I usually in those cases, I can sort of say, well, maybe let's narrow it down a little bit. But just that, like, anything's possible, right? Instead of, well, as we do go, oh, well, I felt, you know, I wasted 2 weeks fiddling with that thing one time and I don't want to go anywhere near that again.
Yeah. Damien, MicroPython Damien, on several occasions on the MicroBit project, I'd say, you know, because I'm not an embedded programmer, you know, would it be possible to do this? And he'd say with a sort of a wistful smile, you know, Nicholas, anything's possible with a computer. It's just whether you've got enough money and time is the answer. But what you've just spoken of, again, speaks to education here, because as software developers, we are constantly learning and forgetting and reconciling and retrieving and synthesizing knowledge and skills and things. It's just part of the job. We're always learning. There's always a new API. There's always a new technology. There's always a new cool thing. And we're also, and this speaks to your point just now, we're kind of learning how to learn. And that's, I think, what I'm trying to do with CodeGrades is give people a safe place where they're learning the right sorts of learning skills so that they can become effective by the time they're grade 8 and understand, I'm new to a project, I'm going to read the docs, I know where to look, I know how to ask for help, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and the ability to pick up a new language or a new library or, you know, how to get through the readme, how to get it installed, those kind of things that you pick up and you're like, I can get started with this new technology because I've done it lots of times, not with this one, but with similar.
So if people are interested in Mew, also link to the madewith.mew website as well. So that's a blog where we put all the goofy projects that people make with Mew or things that that folks have done with Mew. I would say to developers, if you have an opportunity to volunteer in a school or just go in for an hour to tell people what you do, or you have kids and the teacher's asking for help, go and volunteer if you can, because it's an extraordinarily rewarding experience to work with beginner coders. Like you say, there's the perhaps naive optimism, but also there's the energy as well. And sometimes if you're a darkly cynical Eeyore, I like that, I'll use that again. it counterbalances things. It's like Aristotle, you know, when he's talking about you to be brave means to be a little bit foolhardy, but not too foolhardy, and careful, but not coward-like. You know, you've got to kind of try and find the mean, as it were, in this. And so you do want to be naively optimistic in some sense, but at the same time, that needs to be tempered with a sense of, and how long is that going to take you then? You know, and you learn that as you go along. And working with other people, especially beginner programmers, it's a great way to kind of bring those sorts of feelings to the fore. And finally, it's an unambiguously good thing to do.
Yeah. Well, and teaching is, I mean, in some ways too, I see this with, you know, you sort of get used to doing certain things, but like having, as a parent, having kids, you know, my daughters will make brushing teeth so much more interesting and creative and challenging than I thought it could be.
Yes.
And, you know, that's what, and so it just makes it interesting, right? Instead of me just, you know, zoning out, it's like, oh, I never thought about it that way.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. The capacity of creativity when people see an opportunity is wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome.
Link to all these things we've mentioned. And if people want to follow up to help, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Okay. So if they have questions about CodeGrades, there's a form that they can fill in. And when I'm ready with more information, I will just ping people, or they can reach out to me on Twitter. For Mew, we have GitHub. Codewith.mew is the user-facing website, but mew.readthedocs. Is if you're a developer is where you can go if you want to get involved and help there, and I think that's it.
Super
great. All right, well, thanks so much for being on.
Thank you
very
Nicholas.
Much thanks for having me.